This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest is part of the last generation of Buddhists to grow up in a Tibetan monastery. He followed the Dalai Lama to India in 1959, the year Tibet fell to China. After the Chinese invaded Tibet, they destroyed over 6,000 monasteries. Many monks who remained in Tibet were imprisoned. Tens of thousands of Tibetans were sent to labor camps. My guest Sogyal Rinpoche remembers some of Tibet's vanished culture. He's lived in England for over 20 years. His mission is to translate Tibetan Buddhism for Westerners. His new book, The Tibetan Book of Living and Dying, is his attempt to make the concepts of the Tibetan Book of the Dead more accessible to Westerners. By the way, the name Rinpoche means precious one and is a term used for revered spiritual teachers from Tibet. Sogyal Rinpoche was brought to a Tibetan monastery by his parents when he was 6 months old. I asked him if this was a unique situation.
In my case, it was unique because my family was very closely connected with this particular monastery, and in particular with this very great master called Jamen Khyentse Chuchulodu, who I speak very frequently in the book about him. He was very much really like my spiritual father, and that he in many ways was perhaps the greatest Tibetan master of the century. And because of this unique connection, that as they happened to come to the monastery on that particular occasion, and that then it was discovered that my master actually recognized me on that occasion as being the incarnation of this very great mystic and great master called Tertön Sogyal. In fact, I have the same name as him. In fact, it was very interesting that my master gave me the name Sogyal before even he recognized me as an incarnation of this same master with the same name. And this master was, in fact, he was his own master and was also the master of the previous Dalai Lama. That's this present Dalai Lama is the 14th. The previous Dalai Lama is the 13th. He was a very 13th Dalai Lama, and he was his teacher, and he was a very great master.
What does it mean to be recognized as the incarnation of an earlier spiritual leader?
Well, the thing is, you see, as I think many now quite know, I think well know that in Tibet we had this special tradition of really choosing kind of special children from very young to be trained as teachers, and often they're known as the incarnations. And that is to say, when an enlightened master or an enlightened being dies and he doesn't retire into kind of enlightenment, his really pledge and his really vision and compassion is to really work for the benefit of all beings until all beings are liberated from what is called samsara, that is to say, through the confusion and through ignorance, so that in a sense they come back, they send out their emanation, their blessing. If you were to make a comparison with, in a sense, with Christianity, it's more like receiving the grace, that I would see as so. And so they would choose a child in whom their grace or their blessing or their kind of mind is transmitted. And so this child becomes their instrument of their work. And then they, of course, most important is not only the choice of the incarnation, but most important role is the education.
What are some of your early memories of being taught at the monastery?
In my case, you see, I was very fortunate, really, that the master who brought me was perhaps the greatest Tibetan master of the century. And I always remember that kind of the warmth and that kind of the serenity and the peace, the atmosphere that he brought me in. Really, I owe kind of my own confidence in myself, perhaps also the humor, perhaps to this master. And I sometimes believe, you see, when you're born, the environment you're born is like your second womb, and how that environment very much affects your being. So what I remember is of my childhood was not so much the particular things that I've learned, but more thing I remember is the atmosphere, this warm atmosphere of compassion and wisdom that has a really deep effect on my whole being.
Do you remember anything about what daily life in the monastery was like for you?
Oh, yes, it was that I remember. You had to rise up very early in the morning at the kind of crack of dawn. And then I would do my morning prayers, and then I would need to go to my tutor because I was a special child and specially to be brought as a teacher. So I was always assigned to this a very strict tutor who guided my kind of education over 18 hours a day almost. And then so I would go to him and I'd go over and revise this, whatever I've learned. And then when the kind of after a kind of breakfast, which I also have to eat with my tutor, which is not so much fun, then I go over with my tutor over to see my master, to whom I would give the test of each lessons that I've learned. And then he would give the teachings. And then my tutor and I would go over the question that we have and then go and hold a study. So that was the routine. And then there were also, what I really used to enjoy was the days when my master would give very big initiations or like the empowerments and give big teachings. And these teachings were the days when I was free of my studies.
How old were you when China invaded Tibet?
Well, I was about 13 then, around 13 or in my early teens when that happened. In fact, actually the invasion of Tibet took earlier, as you know, in the early 1950s, but the occupation was in 1959.
And then you went to India?
Then we came to India, yes.
How did the spiritual masters who you knew then deal with invasion and bloodshed and all the horrible things that come with that?
Well, of course, with great sadness. But the thing also, what was quite amazing is that they had a really great acceptance in some sense, you see. I remember, for example, myself being quite young, I could cope with changes more easily, but I was amazed with the attitude of some of my parents and many of the elders. They would often say that we are glad that at least we are alive, you know, and then they often used to say, as Buddha taught us, that everything is impermanent. So what is happening to us is this great impermanence. Instead of becoming embittered, in a sense, it really brought them more home to the truth of the teachings. And then also something quite extraordinary is because of the compassion teachings that in a sense they did not make them embittered, in a sense that really they even took, there's a saying, and a wonderful saying in the teaching says, when the one who from whom you expected the most, you see, like a friend or somebody that you trust and from you expect most, if he or she hurts you in the way that you couldn't possibly imagine, may that person become your best teacher. So in many ways that even though the Chinese really turned against us, when we least expect it, in some ways the teachings really kind of provided us that the basis of understanding to really not to turn hatred, to not have hatred against our enemy, but instead to look at them as our greatest teacher from a spiritual point of view.
So when you went to India, your family came too?
In my case, this is very fortunate. Most of my family managed to escape along with my master, yes.
When you lived in India, was that the first time you were exposed to different cultures and different religions?
It was up in Sikkim, actually, which is the Himalayan kingdom. And then it was the Himalayan kingdom. Up in the near Darjeeling, that area of India, yes.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Sogyal Rinpoche, and he was brought up in a Tibetan monastery and now teaches Buddhism. And he's written a new book called The Tibetan Book of Living and Dying. You decided to go west to study at Trinity College, to study comparative religion at Trinity College at Cambridge University. And I guess I'm interested in hearing what inspired you to study other religions.
I think it became more gradual, actually, you see, because as we kind of, you know, were exposed to this completely new world, not because of a choice, but by circumstances, it felt particularly my mother, who had kind of a very special, she had kind of quite a foresight. I quite admired her with a vision. And that, in fact, I owe very much of my education to her, really, vision of coming, for example, to the West and having studied English. She felt that really people like young lamas like myself really should learn English and learn the West of the ways of the outside world. And so I went to a Catholic school to learn the ways of the outside world. In a Catholic school to learn English and to have some kind of a basic Western education. And along with that, I continue my own studies, own Buddhist studies also, because the school is not a whole year round. And then later I went to Delhi University to continue my studies. And then it was kind of almost a natural progression to come to England, because I always felt from really from young, from as we came out into India. And I always felt that my work would be in the West. You know, I had a kind of an intuitive feeling, and I wanted to always come. And then as I came into contact with the Christian fathers, who were very kind to me, who really also respected my faith very much. And so in some ways I became interested in Christianity, and you know, I felt that I should really learn the way of the outside world, way of learn the other religions. So I came to Cambridge on a visiting scholarship to study comparative religion.
I'm still trying to imagine what it was like for you in Catholic school after growing up in a Buddhist monastery in Tibet.
It was very interesting. In fact, somehow, the principal of my school, you see, he was from Switzerland, from an area called Valais near Geneva area, you know, in the Sion. And he was a Catholic from a kind of a missionary school called St. Augustine's. And the father was very kind to me. I always used to see, because I was very much practicing during that time, I used to think very much that even the father, who was the principal, my teacher, my school, as being this, like my own master. In a sense, my education kind of continued, because I always think of this as my teacher.
Were there interesting similarities or conflicts between your Buddhist practices and the Catholic traditions that you were being brought up with?
Of course, there are kind of, you see, at the kind of outset, when you look, forms are very different, and that kind of. But then, as I come to really know the teachings, and as I come to know my own Buddhist teachings more and more, and as I began to understand the Christian teachings more, I began to see increasingly similarities. And also what was wonderful was with these fathers, they were very kind of lenient, you know, was quite an exception, because sometimes missionary schools are quite strict about kind of teaching Christianity. But because of my being kind of a Tibetan Lama, they used to call me Lamala. La is like a respect, Lamala they used to call me. And that, in a sense, they would allow me to have my own shrine in the desks. I would make my own shrine. And for example, first, I used to go to the church quite easily. I had no problem. I learned all the Christian prayers, you know. I was quite comfortable. I did my own practice in the church. But then later, when I became the school kind of the head also, I became the school head, in a sense that all who are non-Christians needn't necessarily go to school, not go to church, and they could go on and have their Buddhist holidays. And I brought some kind of, in some ways, the awareness of other religions in my school a little bit. And also, you see, what was interesting, the fathers actually entrusted me, the school to me. When one of the fathers had to go on to Switzerland on a kind of a long vacation or to meet the family, I think that someone was ill, I was in charge of the school, and I also taught catechism for a while.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Sogyal Rinpoche. He's a Tibetan Lama who fled Tibet after the Chinese invasion. He now lives in England. And he's written a new book that is in a way, a kind of version of the Tibetan Book of the Dead for Western people. It's called The Tibetan Book of Living and Dying. We're going to take a short break. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Sogyal Rinpoche, a Buddhist teacher who grew up in a Tibetan monastery. He's written a new book called The Tibetan Book of Living and Dying. You said that you had a feeling that your work would be in the West, and in fact, your work has been in the West. You've been living in England and lecturing and teaching around the world. What role do you think your Buddhist teachings can serve in the lives of Western Christians, Jews, and Western Muslims?
I think perhaps it would really open the eyes to the true spirituality, I think, you see, because I think what is the unique about Buddhism, and particularly the Tibetan tradition, is not the forms of the religions, but in a sense, it has the lineage of really understanding. That is to say, we have, for example, really we are taught from young. For example, what I've learned from my masters, really the meaning of the scriptures, really the deeper meaning, not just the scriptures, but really the meaning behind the meaning, so to speak. So all these wisdom and compassion, really the practices, the methods of realizing the wisdom, as these are kind of taught, not only taught, they're practiced and they're really experientially transmitted. This is what lineage is. Somehow, in a sense, it really begins to unfold the depth of spirituality. And spirituality becomes really part of life. That's why, for example, Tibet was unique, because the spirituality was really, religion was not just religion on one side, as sometimes often in the West is, you know. The religion is religion and secular life is secular life. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And people go to church only on Sundays and immediately go to a pub. like in England at least. And so in a sense, as you see, that religion or like the spirituality is part of everyday life, that in a sense this is the essential part of the heart of our kind of the of a being. So that is, in some ways, I feel that the Buddhism coming to the West, in some ways, in a sense, helped to renew people of the different religions in their own faith.
It's interesting to me that you've studied comparative religions, and you've studied Catholicism as well as practicing Buddhism, yet you counsel against getting trapped in the West's shopping mentality toward religion. So tell me what it is that you're trying to caution us against there.
I think it's just sometimes I think, you see, like suppose if you're going on a freeway, you know, to a place, and if you keep changing your mind which road you're going to be going forth and backward, probably you're going to sometimes get stuck in a traffic jam, and also even take much longer to get anywhere you want to go. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
In many ways, you see, I find that it's important when you really follow us, want to really follow the spiritual path, it's important to follow one path. And like even in Tibet, to follow like a one master, because by so doing that you actually come to really know intimately the path in a sense. Because you see, there's for example the language, and there's the way of the kind of transmitting, and these, when you come to know the ways of this thing, then you, because what we're trying to communicate in the spiritual teaching, something sometimes which is beyond the mind, which really through really coming to know the teacher and the student both intimately, we can come to really know these teachings. Do you know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
And so through that, you see, once you begin to really understand, have a good grounding in the teaching and the practice, then one can really follow other teachings. In fact, first you must have a good grounding. Like, for example, myself, because I had a fairly good grounding in the Buddhist teachings and practice, as such, it really gives me the freedom to appreciate and to not to, you know, appreciate other religions, such as Christianity, and really see the commonality point. Whereas, if suppose I was not secure in my own faith and in my own practice, and then perhaps I would be less kind of open or perhaps more suspicious. Do you know what I'm saying?
I think so.
And so, as such, I think it's very important to really practice, follow one path, or really to become kind of, to study, to know one path well, and then, because that doesn't mean to say that, you know, you shouldn't be open. You can be open, as my master used to say. He was a very great kind of the leader of the ecumenical movement in Tibet. He used to say, one should practice one's own, but be open to all. So once you really have a path, and once you really understand the teaching, like Buddhist teachings well, then you can even study Christianity and other religions and begin to really not get confused. Whereas if you start picking up here and there, and like with the shopping mentality, perhaps you get bits of wisdom, but you do not know how to put them all together.
Tell us why you wanted to focus a book around death.
I think, you see, I've found that that in the West, there is such a kind of fear about death. And I realized the fear primarily comes from really not knowing very much about what really death is. Because I think the fear comes from this ignorance. And so I felt that really through information, through teachings, by coming to really know what death is, one begins to realize there's something that we can befriend, you know. That death is not a tragedy to be feared, but can be an opportunity for transformation. And so that's one of the reasons. Another thing is with the coming of the Tibetan Book of the Dead, which, as you know, was translated in 1927, even though it was a wonderful teaching, a wonderful scripture, somehow, but this is kind of a little bit advanced, and if it's not really interpreted in the right way, without the full context of the teachings, one would not be able to understand properly. So I had written this book in order to really kind of bring it into context, the Tibetan teachings on life and death. I think I want to emphasize this is not just a book of really dead, but also about life, so as to give really the complete vision of the living and dying, of which the Tibetan Book of the Dead forms an important part. It explains the context, the background, the meaning of the teachings behind the Tibetan Book of the Dead, and it gives the key to the understanding of it.
How old were you when your spiritual master died?
I was about 13 that time, you see.
And
that was really a, in a sense, like the whole ground of my existence kind of fell apart.
Were you Were you near him when he died?
Yes, I was near him. In fact, I always used to sleep next to him. But I remember early that morning, the day that he died, I was taken very early from the place. And for 3 days, I did not know that he had passed away. It was kind of kept secret because sometimes, you see, it's believed that according to the Buddhist tradition that some of the great masters, when they die, they actually enter into meditation for sometimes 3 days. In my case of my master, as I mentioned in the book about the story of his death, that he actually rested in meditation for 3 days, and it was quite an extraordinary experience. So I didn't come to know about it until about 3 days after.
When you say rested in meditation, you mean meditating in such a way that some might think he's dead even though he's still alive?
It's like this, that you see, the outer, like for example, when you breathe out last, even though the outer breath has ceased, but inner breath is still going on. In such cases of actually practitioners, not only masters, but many practitioners, it's quite a common phenomenon in Tibet, that you see that you can feel a kind of a warmth at the heart, the whole complexion, even though they are kind of pronounced as clinically dead, but there you can see this really, the color of the doesn't fade away. They're really, you know, they're just very much like alive. And when they come out of the meditation of the 3 days, then the color goes away and, you know, the head droop. Until that, I'm sometimes even rest in the meditative posture and die in that state.
Did you think that your spiritual master was using his death as a lesson? I don't mean that he was dying to teach you a lesson, but did he, during his death, use that as a lesson for you?
I think so, very much so, really. And I think he taught me so much in his death, and then also even now, I sometimes feel he's always teaching me. In fact, you know, all the great masters that I met after his death, I always felt that it was he was brought to me, bringing to them all.
Could you tell us something about what you think you learned from watching him die?
Well, I think it's, you see, I think first of all that we always, you see, even though it's certain that we're going to die, somehow, since it's uncertain when or how we're going to die, somehow we kind of think it's not going to happen to you, and that we have an unlimited lease on our life. And when even the master like him died, then of course me, you know. So it was like to wake up the soul for the naive like me to really the truth of impermanence and the death, that the death is a reality. And so therefore, when that is the case, that at the moment of death, only that thing that would help me was my spiritual practice. So therefore, in a sense, it really helps me to focus on my spiritual practice and really face the truth of myself, which is what facing death is. Facing death is facing the truth of yourself.
Have you ever returned to Tibet since you fled there?
No, not yet, no.
Would you want to, if you could?
I want to, but I think it's also I want the situation and circumstances to change there. In a sense, because I think some ways, I sometimes feel that I would probably miss Tibet more when I'm in Tibet.
Because it won't be anything like what you remember?
Yes, true. And it'd be kind of rather, really, it's like going back to a place where you had such a wonderful time, but then when you go there, you know, you become even more sad.
I want to thank you very much for talking with
thank
us.
Thank you. Thank you.
Sogyal Rinpoche is the founder and director of Rigpa, a network of Buddhist centers around the world. His new book is The Tibetan Book of Living and Dying. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.